This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. You heard our political analyst take on the news from the presidential race. Now we continue the political beat and head to news from Kenya with our weekly Reporters Roundtable. Today we've got Clarence Page, a columnist for the Chicago Tribune, also John Yearwood, a world editor of the Miami Herald, and Bob Mosier, a contributing writer to The Nation magazine. Welcome, folks.
Hi.
Hi. Hello, Farai.
So there is so much to talk about. Bob, what do you make of Obama mania, particularly in a 93% white state? He got a nice, comfortable first place. Is this a landmark for race in America, or is this more personality-based politics?
I think that that's still still to be determined at this point. I think that it could be personality-based politics, and I think that's something that that black voters in particular in South Carolina, who I've been talking to, have been concerned with. They've been reluctant to support Obama or to throw their support behind Obama, in part because they weren't sure that he was part of the movement or represented a new movement. And so I think that this is a great victory, and but I think it remains to be seen whether this really will be a kind of new a new movement and a second Reconstruction, as people are hoping for in the South.
Before I bring other folks into this, Bob, do you think, you know, having been on the South Carolina path, that in some ways African Americans are more skeptical of Barack Obama than whites?
Yes, absolutely, they are, and the skepticism runs both ways. There's a skepticism that's been very powerful and unfortunate about whether or not he could win simply because he's black. And I think that skepticism has run even higher in the black community, especially in South Carolina. On the other hand, there's skepticism about whether he's a true black leader in the mold that people are familiar with. And so he's had two obstacles in a lot of ways with black voters.
Clarence, how does this parse out to you? You've been covering politics on the national level, many, many races. How does race...
Back to the Thomas Jefferson race there.
Stop. Stop. But, how does this fundamentally change the game, if at all?
Well, I can tell the South Carolina voters that black voters in Chicago were skeptical of Obama at first, too, and he won folks over. And I find it hard to believe... I think that Iowa gives him a big boost in terms of, even though we don't know what happens in New Hampshire or Nevada or whatever, yet it's going to be hard for black voters, I would think, in South Carolina, to vote for Hillary Clinton if Obama appears to be as viable as he is. He has just made history being the first black candidate to win the Iowa caucuses. That's not a small achievement. And he knows how to walk the walk and talk the talk. I think Obama's biggest impediment, from what I've been able to tell down south, has been friends of Bill and Hillary Clinton, Andy Young or Jim Clyburn in South Carolina, and other folks who are loyal to the Clintons and have not been encouraging folks to look at Obama, but he seems to be gaining ground.
John, do you think that there's going to be a case of winneritis, which is that a lot of people, a lot of voters, and this has been shown in many different studies, they want to vote for a winner. And so if Obama seems to be a winner, they're going to kind of get on that trail, people who've been undecided. Do you think that Senator Obama is going to benefit from that psychology?
Well, Farai, I think everyone loves a winner, and to some extent, I agree with you. I think that once Obama starts winning, more and more people would say, well, we have a winner. He can win. We should support him. At the same time, it would be once the race gets into South Carolina, it would be interesting to see how blacks in South Carolina react, because if you listen to pundits over the last several years, America's already had a black president, so they may think that we'll stay with the horse that we know. In this case, we'll stay with the Clintons, because clearly during the Clinton administration, he did a lot that benefited blacks. One of the things in listening and in watching last night and in listening to the analysis of the Obama race, the Obama outcome, one question that I have, and I think a lot of people are saying within the black community, more don't tell me what you're going to do. Show me. And I think to a lot of people, Obama has not yet shown blacks what he has done in the black community. And I think that's part of the part of the campaign going forward, as he now broadens his message to include more African Americans.
John, you're in Florida. It's a state where, for example, Republican candidate Rudy Giuliani intends to make a stand. Some people have been saying, look, it's too late. It's going to be too late to wait for the Florida contest. What are people in Florida saying about your place statewide in the national election process?
Well, there are a couple of things about that, Farai. As you know, going on the Democratic side anyway, going into the Florida primary, Florida does not have any delegates. So the question for us is wondering whether or not the Democrats are going to spend a great deal of time here, because now that it's become a real dogfight, whether or not the big question is to rack up the delegates instead of coming in and maybe getting momentum. So one of the things that we're waiting to hear from the candidates is whether or not they are going to spend much time in Florida on the Democratic side. Now, on the Republican side, as you know, Rudy has spent a great deal of time here in Florida. He has gotten a great deal of goodwill on the part of a lot of Republicans. But given the results last night and the results that we're going to see next week in Iowa, where he is not expected to do well, there is only, you know, people down here in Florida are only so patient. And based on some of the people that I've spoken with here, I'm not quite sure whether or not Florida will be the firewall that Rudy anticipates that it will be.
Bob, I want to ask you just quickly about something that has been generating a couple of cocked eyebrows. There have been several pastors who've endorsed Mike Huckabee. They got letters in the mail warning them of mixing church and politics. These letters don't have any return addresses, but they say endorsing candidates could threaten their tax-exempt status. There's been a long history of, you know, shady politicking, from signs mysteriously appearing in black neighborhoods saying that if you had unpaid taxes that you'd be arrested at the polls, and so on and so on. Was this another example of someone doing something very much across an ethical line?
Well, it certainly sounds that way, and I don't know enough to judge whether that's the case or not in this particular case, but Certainly, that's happening, and there were a lot of very disturbing things happening in Iowa, and I think that there's certainly some reason for concern as we come to the South Carolina primary, because the history there has had some very, very nasty and unethical tactics, and including last time in the 2000 race when John McCain was rumored to have fathered an African-American baby. And I think that a lot of the same operatives for McCain and for Romney are still working there, who were working there in 2000. So I think we may see a really nasty campaign there, unfortunately, and more of those tactics that you're talking about.
Clarence, John, do you think there's going to be any of the Book of Dirty Tricks being opened up and folks going to that as this tight race continues?
I can hear the mud being scooped up already. You know, this inevitably happens after you have races begin to tighten up and the stakes are obviously high. I think that campaign, that leafleting campaign you're talking about there, warning churches about their tax exempt status. I've seen the same thing happen in urban campaigns to try to suppress the black vote and discourage ministers from letting certain candidates speak in their church and this sort of thing. It's a pretty old tactic.
And I agree with Clarence. And Clarence, you may recall we saw that 4 years ago on the part of the Republicans sending out letters, in fact, in the part of I believe it was the Justice Department at the time, sending out letters to ministers at various churches.
Yes.
Where candidates were either speaking or where ministers had announced that they were going to support certain candidates, saying it may be against the law. We may be seeing some of that again in this case. By the way, at the end of the day, when all of that was decided, I don't believe that there were any charges filed on the part of the government against any of these ministers. So it was just an attempt to try to suppress the vote. And I don't doubt, as Clarence says, that we'll be seeing more of this as we go forward with the campaign.
All right. If you're just tuning in, I want to refresh everybody what we're doing. It's our weekly Reporters Roundtable. This is NPR's News and Notes. I am Farai Chidea. We are speaking with John Yearwood, a world editor of the Miami Herald, Clarence Page, a columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and also Bob Mosier, contributing writer to The Nation magazine. John, you have been tracking Kenyan politics this week. There's been an absolute explosion of protest and violence over the outcome of the elections. How are you tracking this for your paper and for yourself?
Yeah. You know, one of the things in looking at what's happening in Kenya, it's been really sad to watch, particularly since I've been following Kenyan politics for about two decades. I know Raila Odinga, the opposition leader, first met him almost 20 years ago when I was in Kenya writing about this movement that was happening at the time toward political pluralism. Indeed, at the time, he had been arrested. He'd been followed by the secret police. In fact, we were at a meeting one day, and he said to me, the secret police follows me everywhere, and I'll show you proof of that. Let's go. We were heading to another meeting, and he said, instead of taking the elevators in this building, let's take the stairwell. We went down the stairwell, and halfway down, there were three men standing in the stairwell. They sort of nodded at each other, and he kept going. And when we got out of the building, he says, that's the secret police that's been following me. The good news coming out of that is that 5 years ago, he was part of this coalition that was elected with President Kibaki, and many of us had so much hope for Kenya at the time that Kenya was now going to become far more democratic than it had before after almost 30 years of the previous president, Daniel Arap Moi. Now, this has really got a lot of us scratching our heads and wondering, you know, what's happening to Kenya, and hoping that the international community, and we're seeing to some extent, we're seeing some of it happening now because things are much better today than they were earlier in the week. President Kibaki is talking about, if the courts agree, he's willing to have another election. But this President Kibaki, who many of us thought was going to be far more of a democratic president, has turned out to be anything but. And I think that the international community needs to keep his feet to the fire and be very vigilant as we look at what's happening in Kenya now.
He hasn't been much of a friend to the press, has he, either?
He has not, and in fact, and neither has his wife. And there have been many reports about a few years after he was elected, his wife went to one of the newspapers and I think slapped around one of the editors because she was not in favor of the reporting on her. But a lot of the things that he's been doing, shortly after the elections were announced by this electoral commission, the commission to look at the elections, the electoral commission, the head of the commission said that he was pressured into giving into announcing the results early. And the president, it seems like within minutes after the announcement came, the president was inaugurated, was sworn in for a second term, which is so much unlike what happened the first time when there was a great deal of celebration that a new day had arrived in Kenya. And the more that we've got to learn about him over the last several years, the more we see that he's more in the vein of his predecessor, President Moi, than he is of even really as a father, Oginga Odinga, the former vice president of Kenya.
Let me get Bob and Clarence in this. Bob, there was, of course, the bombing of the U.S. embassy in Kenya, and that preceded 9/11. Do you think that for either strategic reasons or humanitarian reasons that the U.S. government, the current administration, will plug into what's going on in Kenya? And if so, how?
I don't know that they will. Of course, it would be quite hypocritical if they did not, for all the time that they've spent talking about democracy. But I do. I think one of the problems here is that there's so little understanding of Kenya or of politics, and I'm one of the people who doesn't understand it, you know, as nearly as well as John. But it seems to me that the media coverage has been very confused and confusing, and that makes it, you know, easier for the Bush administration not to be putting as much pressure as they might to bear on this, because it's a clear situation. It's a fairly clear situation there. And but it does seem that there's an attempt to portray what's happening in Kenya as another example of, you know, even Rwanda. It's the media doesn't understand Kenya very well, and I think that's unfortunately that affects what our foreign policy is toward them.
Clarence, do you think that the U.S. is going to invest on any level? I mean,
we already are. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is sending her top diplomat over there to try to talk to Odinga and Kibaki. Try to get some. She's called for some kind of a reconciliation, whether it is through a recount, which the European Union has called for, because their monitors got you know, kind of knocked around and obstructed during this election, or a whole revote, which is what a lot of Odinga's supporters want. This is something, though, that something needs to be done, because Kenya is just too important. It has been the most important country in so many ways in East Africa, not just since since Bush's war on terror, but as a commercial hub, as a transportation hub, a media hub, etc. And it's just a terrible tragedy what has happened here. But we can hope that Odinga and Kibaki, because of their past coalition, that there are avenues here to bring them together, and they've given verbal indications that they are willing to negotiate, but they're too far apart to get into the same room just yet.
Well, we're going to definitely keep our eye on this. And gentlemen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Fry.
Clarence Page is a columnist for the Chicago Tribune. John Yearwood is world editor of the Miami Herald, and he joined us from member station WLRN in Miami, Florida. And Bob Mosier is a contributing writer to The Nation magazine. Next on News and Notes, two very different stories about people who both had the courage to ask for what they wanted and the fight to make their dreams come true.